and vitamins. Irons in the niacin. Out of the loop, I'm fair. Rappers sit back, I'm about to begin. Bow, foul, talk, you squaw. Never even walk the wall. More or less destined to get tested. Never been arrested. My album will manifest many things that I saw, did, or heard about. Or told firsthand. Never word of mouth. What's in the future for the fusion and the change? Rappers are in danger. Who will use wits to be a remainder? When the missile is aimed to blow you out of the frame. Some will keep their limbs in. Some will be maimed. The same suckers with the gab about. Killer instincts returned. And when this if damn will they lack in this division, the clown is sore. Cracking your head with a 4x4. Realize, sucker, I'll be the coming like Noah. Or will simmer you down. Perpetrating facade in what you consider an image. To me, this is just a scrimmage. I feel I'm stoned. Not cause of Papa wear my cap cocked. The more emotion I put into it, the harder I rock. Those who pose lyrical but really ain't true, I feel. About what you did, but you never done it. Admit it, you bit it, cause the next man came flapping them behind it. I find it ironic. So I researched and analyzed. Most write about stuff they fantasize. I'm fed up with the bull on this focus of weed and clips and Glocks getting caught and wax not being flipped. It's the same old, just straining from the anal. The contact is not complex, the vex. So why you pushing it? Why you lying for? I know where you live, I know your folks. You was a sucker as a kid. Your persona's drama that you acquired in high school and acting class. Your whole aura is plexiglass. What's the face told me you shot this kid last week in the park? That's a lie. You was in church with your mom. See, I know. Yo, slow your roll. Get real good to go. Guys be locking in this thing called rapping just for dough. Of course, we gotta pay rent so money connects. But I'd rather be broke than have a whole lot of respect. It's the principle of it. I get a rush when I bust some dope lines or roll. That maybe somebody will quote. That's what I consider real in this field of music. Instead of putting brain cells to work, they abuse it. Non-conceptual, non-exceptional. Everybody's either crime-related or sexual. I'm here to make a difference. Besides all the riffing, the traps I'm not sticking. Rappers stop flipping for those who pose lyrical, but really ain't true, I feel.
All right, this is WPFW 89.3 FM, a Pacifica station. You're on with Community Watch and Comment. I am Dr. Hate. And I was hanging out last week with my man. And I was asking him some questions. And he was like, I need you to tell the people this. So when I was talking with Pope Francis, he was saying that Jesus Christ was a victim of a fascist Western police state sting operation. They were rolling up all of the comedic priests at the time. And they were like, this is one of the last ones we got to get. The rest of them cats went west to Mali and some cats called the Dogons or something. So he's like, Jesus Christ was the victim of a fascist Western police state sting operation. And they had him in a lineup. And guess who the folk that was identifying him was? He said Judas came up and was like, yeah, yeah, that's him. He did it. He's the one. Grab him. And then the Pope told me the real stuff about the Vatican. He was like, once the Romans got Jesus, they were like, they just flipped the whole thing and just took the religion over. And it's no longer anything to do with the comedic practices. They just rocked in the soot bitty hats with the red and white cap on the dome, burned some frankincense and myrrh like the three kings coming. And I was like, yo, that's deep, man. You know, if you talk to Pope Francis personally, I got him on speed dial. He'll tell you the truth. I give you the number after the show. This is Community Watch and Comment, where we take your stories of the week. Last week, we were looking at the Pope. This week, Howard Homecoming's happening next week. What did I just talk about? Judas Factor? The Million Man March is coming. Those who would kill King, those who would kill Malcolm, those who would kill... You get the point where this is going. Hopefully, we won't see you there. I know I won't be in the building, but we'll see what you're doing about that and get your thoughts on it next week. But right now, we got Brian Kolber with us, and we were talking Hubert Henry Harrison and the betrayers of the Black Revolution and Du Bois at the moment and where Hubert Henry Harrison was at the time. So we were leaving off, right, with this conversation about Harrison and his work with Garvey, going from founding The Voice as one of the premier Black news journal outlets to working with the Negro World and the UNIA, right? Mm-hmm. Redesigns it, makes it hot.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, he's looking at Garvey as this propagandist, which is, you know, real curious, because you were talking about how they chose the words democracy in their anti World War One stance, and saying that if you talk democracy around the world, we want democracy for the Africans too, right? Cool, but that democracy pitch comes out of Edward Bernays, who is the nephew of Freud. And as Bernays is using Freud's work, he recognizes that there are some unconscious spaces that we can start giving people the language to fill in those unconscious spaces. And rather than saying that we want to take power back for the old empires as a tagline for why the U.S. is going to war, Bernays says, say that you want to bring democracy and make the world safer for democracy. So this is all happening around World War One, and Garvey and Hubert Henry Harrison and Du Bois and folks are all operating in that time and space with the same kind of propaganda. So Garvey takes it as, like, you know, one set of propaganda, but Harrison looks at it like, we're just saying this, we don't actually believe it. We don't recognize democracy is ever going to be brought by the U.S. to the African people. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because Harrison, you know, he was right at that time, as you said, the advertising and PR industry were kind of coming into existence with Bernays and the Creel Commission, which was set up by the Wilson administration as essentially the propaganda office for the government in the war. And Harrison is, you know, he's analyzing how they repeat phrases over and over and over. There's this funny article Harrison writes called You Need a Biscuit, which was about these ads that were going on for this biscuit maker. And he was saying how you see you need a biscuit billboards, and when you see it once and then twice and then three times and four times, even if you never needed a biscuit, eventually you'll start to think you need a biscuit.
I'm going to need that biscuit.
And he was saying, this is exactly how the war propaganda works. They say, we need to spread democracy. We need to make the world safe for democracy. Democracy, democracy, democracy. And then the paradoxical thing about it, or the ironic part about it, was that by using that as their war justification, the Wilson administration and the Western European powers more generally actually did get people of color around the world, you know, Asians, Africans, Latin Americans, and so on, Caribbeans, to actually want democracy and to actually say, yeah, we okay, let's have some democracy if you're advertising this to us. And so that actually spurred a lot of the New Negro movement awakening. It was this kind of radicalization that took place, particularly among, you know, for example, black troops who had fought supposedly for democracy in Europe and then come home to lynching and Jim Crow and segregation and no democracy whatsoever. So so that's part of what's going on. Now, Garvey was a great propagandist, and in a positive sense, in terms of spreading a different message, spreading a more, you know, black positive message around self-empowerment, self-respect, you know, Africa for the Africans, this kind of message. And but it's interesting because when we look actually more closely at it, there were also certain aspects of Garveyism that I think were not as helpful. For example, when the UNIA had a plank that said we want to promote civilizing the backward tribes of Africa, that was something that was quite common at the time among colonial thinkers, you know, the white Europeans who said we need to civilize these savages, we need to, you know, uplift and Christianize them and so on. And unfortunately, a lot of black leaders, Garvey included, had a similar look at African people. And Harrison, by contrast, actually had the opposite approach. He said we need to learn from Africans, we need to listen to what they have to teach us. And he had this kind of radical humility towards African people, which I think is one of the most unique features of Harrison's thought in this period, particularly since so many other people, you know, had that kind of civilizing mission in their minds. And so that's something that, you know, I've looked at with Harrison as really defining and an important part of what he was bringing to the discussion around Africa and looking at Africans as a people who, you know, had their own traditions, their own, you know, religious and spiritual customs, their own systems of trade and agriculture and commerce. He said, basically, who are we to pretend to be anxious about the political welfare of Africans if we can't name their gods and their, you know, trade systems and their sciences and their communities and their ethnic groups? And so he was quite quite a unique thinker in that sense.
Absolutely. I want to get more into the intellectual prowess piece, because it's said he is the foremost intellect at that time, right? But in the meantime, we got folks who are on the line. I'm going to get with you in 1 second. I just want to give the name of the dissertation. It's called In Search of Purity, Popular Eugenics and Racial Uplift. So you can check that out for yourselves, right? This is by S.Y. Sherman, In Search of Purity, Popular Eugenics and Racial Uplift. If you want to actually go in and get the Du Bois quotes, you can get them there. Folks are also asking, like, where can we find the sources for the Du Bois treachery in supporting World War One? And we mentioned When Africa Awakes, where, you know, the series of writings of Harrison are documented. But where else might we find some of those things?
Yeah, there's two Harrison oriented books that exist now that are helpful. One is the Hubert Harrison Reader, which is an edited volume of Harrison's writings by Jeff Perry. The other is the first of a two-volume biography, also by Perry, that I mentioned, called Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, or something like that. And so in both of those books, you can find information about the Du Bois, Harrison, and World War One, and all that.
All right, wonderful. So we got callers on the line. Let's take a few callers, and we'll come right back with the conversation with Brian Quoba and Hubert Henry Harrison. But I want to continue with this conversation with good brother here, Brian Quoba, and we're talking Hubert Henry Harrison. Now, one of the things that you left off with was just talking about how Harrison was developing his league of folks, right? So I want you to talk a little bit about that and bringing together different African peoples around the globe and his vision for that. And I want to know, you know, in the academic world, we always have these conversations between are you a Pan-African or are you an African nationalist? And that might represent which thread that you rock with, right? Did Harrison see distinctions in that? How did he identify him? How would you classify him? Do you see those distinctions between African nationalism and Pan-Africanism, one being more the congresses and conferences that were brought together by Henry Sylvester and then Du Bois and folk get involved later in the 1900s, right? But mid-1900s, but the African nationalist thread is more of the UNIA's Garveyite Africa for the Africa for Africans at home and abroad. Where does Hubert Henry Harrison fit in there?
Well, I think he's in some ways in both camps, or different camps at different times, in a sense. And I like Malcolm, he's a figure who you have to look at the totality of his life and his trajectory, because oftentimes one experience he has, positive or negative, shapes what he then goes on to do afterwards. So, for example, you know, his experience with the white left pushed him towards what we would now call a more sort of black nationalist type of position. A race first is what the slogan was, because he had experienced the so-called class first arguments of the socialist and found them to be actually white first. They were race first arguments in the guise of class first. And so he said, well, if the white left is going to be take race first, then we have to develop in a kind of reaction to that. Like, we need to put our racial interests first. And the kind of race first idea kind of came out for Harrison, came out of that experience. But in terms of your question, so Harrison, in 1920, Harrison 21, Harrison's calling for what he calls a colored international. That is an international grouping of folks, the people of color around the world, African, Asian, and Middle Eastern, and so on and so forth, much like what eventually came to fruition in the Bandung Conference. In that sense, he's kind of had a certain third worldist or kind of, black internationalist politic. But a couple of years later, when he's organizing his International Colored Unity League, that's a very Pan-African formation. It's Africans from the continent, Afro-Caribbeans, and African-Americans in the same organization. And so, you know, he's got this kind of, on the one hand, he's got this kind of Pan-African and African-centeredness to him, but he was broader than that. He sought to unite what he called the darker races of the world in the struggle against colonialism and imperialism and capitalism, which was exploiting, you know, all these workers in different parts of the world. So he's a complex figure, and I think he defies easy characterization. And also, he lived at a time before some of these rigid divisions were as clear-cut as they are today. And in that sense, he was a pioneer and a political ancestor to many of the tendencies and traditions that we have seen develop subsequently.
Now, but I want to stress that out a little bit more, because folks may ask, like, what is the difference between the Pan-African Congresses and such? And the first five are all held outside of the continent of Africa and in Europe. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the first five also did not have any agenda that was anti-imperial. It seemed more to say that Africans want to be in control of their own governments under the empire and protection of the colonial powers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I would say
it's not a nice statement. It doesn't feel good to say it. I don't think I've ever said it like that.
Right.
I don't know if I'm accurate there. If I'm wrong, correct me, please.
One way to think about it is to say that the Pan-African project among the Du Boises and those folks in the early 20th century was a kind of Pan-Africanism of the talented tenth. That is, for example, when Du Bois goes to Paris for the peace conference after World War I, and he starts organizing the Pan-African Congress there in France, his vision is sort of getting the talented tenth of Africa to play a greater role in shaping the outcome of Africa. So, for example, Germany, who had lost the war, you know, he was saying Germany's colonies should be transferred to some kind of international body of sorts, including the African American sort of educated sectors, because we can better administer those colonies. And so there was an aspect of, I think, paternalism and a kind of top-down Pan-Africanism in a sense. But obviously, beginning with the 5th Pan-African Congress in Manchester and subsequently, Pan-Africanism took on more of a mass character and got beyond just the talented 10th, I think, in many ways. And so I don't know if that's a helpful way to think about it, but...
Well, it is, because I want to move, like, I want to see, does Harrison sit in that space? Mm-hmm. Is he pro-empire and trying to govern African people under the protection of the empire?
No,
if
no.
Not, then he's. How do we look at it in terms of his ideas of sovereignty and building the empire that, you know, Garvey then wants to also build through the UNIA, please?
Well, Harrison was not at all cut from that cloth. He had, as I mentioned earlier, kind of radical humility towards African people, and he was a staunch and sharp anti-colonialist. He denounced, the British, the Belgians, the French, all of the colonial powers, not only in Africa, but also in other places. You know, he wrote articles about India. He wrote articles about what he called the cracker in the Caribbean, that is, U.S. Militarism and imperialism in St. Croix, his native island of St. Croix, what became the U.S. Virgin Islands, and also in Haiti, which was occupied for almost 20 years, from 1915 to 1934, by the U.S. military. And so Harrison's thing was like, we need to fight here at home. And this is part of his issue, the issue that he developed with the Garvey movement, is he felt like it was kind of taking energy away from the home struggle. If we're going back to Africa in some way, shape, or form, then how are we going to be fighting lynching? How are we going to be fighting segregation? How are we going to be fighting, for the right to vote and so on here at home? And he said this was his critique of a lot of the folks who wanted to go to Paris for the peace conference, people like A. Philip Randolph, Ida B. Wells, Du Bois, and others. He said, our fight is here. You know, lynching and segregation, these are evils here. Our fight is here. If you don't have anything to say about that, then get out the way so we can continue with the work of that. And so that's an interesting aspect of what he's saying at this point.
All right, cool. Let's pause there for a second because I want to come back and get his ideas on... Brian, give us some of the words and the intellect of Hubert Henry Harrison, please.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start actually, if I may, with an anecdote, just for folks who may not be familiar with kind of what Harrison was about, and how he spread his message and got his ideas out there. Because one of the traditions that he pioneered in Harlem was the tradition of soapbox oratory, getting up on street corners and just speaking to the people. So I'm going to share a quick anecdote from a guy called William Pickens, who was a field secretary of the NAACP. He said, "The age of Pericles and Socrates in ancient Athens had nothing on the present age of Harlem in New York. Coming out of the movies between 137th and 138th Street on 7th Avenue, we saw one of the biggest street corner audiences that we've ever met in this block, which is famous for street corner lectures. This was not a selected audience, but the run of the street, and their faces were fixed on a black man who stood on a ladder platform with his back to the avenue and the passing buses, and his face to the audience, which blocked the spacious sidewalk. And what was he talking about? Evolution. The theory of evolution and its illustration in different lines of material and biological development. The Darwinian science of the evolution of life and the Marxian philosophy of the evolution of capitalism and a possible development from capitalism to a state of communism. I have the sorry burden of listening to so many poor lecturers indoors, including those of my own, that I seldom tarry at street corner talk, but catching wind of the subject, I wanted to see what a random Harlem audience would do at such a lecture, with autos, two-story buses, and clanging fire engines passing. Not in my life have I seen a more attentive audience at a lecture on a subject of this magnitude. How much were they getting? Their faces were certainly fixed on the speaker, who was Hubert H. Harrison. In half an hour, none of those who were near enough to hear left, and none seemed to lose attention. The only time when there seemed to be smiles and bits of merriment was when the speaker fell to discussing certain theological dogmas and some hard-boiled religious creeds in the light of evolutionary science. I noticed that when he bore down on the fixed, immovable, and unprogressive science of the pulpit, the people laughed. Now, why is it that people will listen like this to a street talk on what is proverbially supposed to be a dry subject, and yet are supposed to be uninclined to attend indoor sermons and lectures? I tell you, there must be something missing in those formal discourses. This street talk was virile and unconventional. Most of the indoor kind are platitudinous, artificial, and lack courage. A fellow who is burdened with the weight of a church, a school, or some other institution is afraid to say some of the things which Harrison said boldly on this street corner. The indoor talks are generally limited, muzzled, tongue-tied. This street talk was unchained, free, even daring. Perhaps, like Socrates, we must pursue truth on the street corners and seek the beautiful and the good in the mob and among the outcasts." So that gives, I think, a picture of Harrison. You know, he literally could block traffic with the crowds that he would draw for his street corner speeches and orations. And just to get back to your point about Harrison's words. I shared this idea, but I wanted to give a quote from Harrison about his relationship to African people and how he conceived of learning from them. This is a quote from an article that he was writing around the time of the Pan-African Congresses in France that Du Bois was organizing. He said, and part of kind of his Garveyist phase, he said, "Let us go there. Not in the coastlands, but in the interior, in Nigeria and Nyasaland. Let us study engineering and physics, chemistry and commerce, agriculture and industry. Let us learn more of nitrates, of copper, rubber, and electricity, so we will know why Belgium, France, England, and Germany want to be in Africa. Let us begin by studying the scientific world of the African explorers, and stop reading and believing the silly slush which ignorant missionaries put into our heads about the alleged degradation of our people in Africa. Let us learn to know Africa and Africans so well that every educated Negro will be able, at a glance, to put his hands on the map of Africa and tell us where to find the Jolofs, Ekois, Mandingos, Yorubas, Bechuanas, or Basutos, and can tell something of their marriage customs, their property laws, their agriculture, and systems of worship. For not until we can do this will it be seemly for us to pretend to be anxious about their political welfare.
That's a powerful statement right there. Because he's actually talking about the peoples, not just the land, but the actual peoples, right? As not divided up by the Berlin Conference and partitioned for the European powers, but who are the people? And then the second piece is, why were the Belgian going in there? So he's thinking about that, you know, that same situation we talk about in Friends of Africa Folks with Maurice and Kimbali always bring to the fore. That the coltan in the Congo is really what these wars are about, and folks are trying to control the mineral resources there. Okay, I like this guy. We should know more about Hubert Henry Harrison.
Yeah.
We have any callers on the line right now? Call in 202-588-0893 if you want to weigh in on some of the subjects we've been discussing thus far. So, with that notion, then, we left off with the community league, the Colored Unity League.
International Colored Unity League.
Okay, cool. What happens to that now? Take us to the end of Harrison's life and what his legacy is and how he transitions and what he was doing in the U.S. through the 20s.
Yeah, well, the International Colored Unity League was his kind of the last organizing, major organizing effort that he undertook. And one of the things, it emphasized a kind of pan-African sensibility in the sense that it brought in Africans from the continent, from the Caribbean, and from the U.S., African-Americans, into a formation which, for example, called for a separate state in the United States, a separate territory, sort of a forerunner to the Republic of New Africa idea, in a sense. It called for, you know, black entrepreneurs and cooperatives to be established and kind of working together in order to cut out the white middleman and, you know, organize food, you know, the growing of food, the distribution of resources and stuff for the black community. And then he put out a publication called the Voice of the Negro, I believe it was, which, you know, was designed to kind of be a place where some of these ideas would be spread and chapters could be set up in different places to build support for what he was doing. And then in 1927, Harrison, you know, he actually died from a botched appendicitis operation, and it's sad because I think his dying young and before some of the dramatic events of the 1930s meant that it was even more likely that or easier to erase him from history and forget about him. And what's shocking about it is that even at the time that he died, I mean, masses of people came to his funeral. He was extremely popular, you know, in Harlem and in New York City. And there was even actually a Hubert Harrison Memorial Church that was set up for a time after he had passed on by people like Reverend Ethelred Brown. But the official response was actually quite silent. So journals like The Crisis or Opportunity, there was silence when Harrison died in those quarters, those kind of talented 10th-oriented publications. And it's telling that, in other words, the erasure of Harrison's memory began right when he passed on, in the sense that certain forces who he had criticized or who he had had differences of opinion with didn't seem to think it necessary to write about his passing and eulogize him and thereby help to memorialize what A. Philip Randolph called the father of Harlem radicalism.
All right, this is Brian Quoba and Dr. Hate in with Community Watch and Comment, where we take your stories of the week. We've been continuing this conversation with Hubert Henry Harrison. We got Baba Skia coming on next. But we want to take one last call in for Community Watch and Comment. What's your story of the week, or the week story you want to hate on? What you thinking?
Well, I'm not going to really hate on anything, but I do want to make an observation. Earlier in the show, you mentioned use of the English language and certainly, I suppose, an adoption of Western cultures being an act of hate. Is that also true of people of color who adopt and adapt Western civilization and use the English language as hating on themselves? I didn't quite get the rationale that you were coming from. But what I do find is that on a subconscious level, as you know, when Dr. Du Bois talked about educated Negroes, what constitutes an educated Negro? I mean, at many times we tend to use the same certifications, either decidedly or subconsciously, to level credibility to those people that we tend to adopt as experts or leadership or guidance in our community. So, I mean, I'm thinking that it might even entail being a constant process of adjustment for us not to engage in the same continuum, you know, that the oppressor has done, either subconsciously. Sometimes it could, people have personal access to crime, but we never know. But if we're going to move this thing forward, as was played on Malcolm, put our petty differences aside. That's all I have to say.
Mm.
Brian, why don't you take that?
Yeah, I think that's an important point because, you know, as somebody who's getting a PhD at the University of Oxford, certainly, you know, that's something that I'm doing not because of necessarily the intellectual environment or what Oxford has to offer, because Oxford is a very white, Eurocentric, and kind of racist institution, like so many institutions of higher learning in the Western world. But I do think the sort of cachet that it has hopefully will help me to get a job, you know, and to be able to put food on the table and you know, teach undergraduates, which is what I want to do. So I'll say that, you know, a lot of what I've learned, not just about Harrison but others, has been outside of those kind of mainstream, established, so-called prestigious institutions. And I think that's where real knowledge and real truths about the world and alternative non-Western, black, and African-centered epistemologies can be found. And so I think it's all part of the process. We got to decolonize the minds, and however we can do that, in or outside of academia, we got to try for it.
All right. We want to thank you very much to that caller. I'll just say that if language is spoken through the mouth, the language of the oppressor means that your mouth is occupied. And we want to thank you very much for calling in Community Watch and Comment. We're going to stay tuned for Baba Skia with the news and latest and going on. Thank you very much. It's Dr. Hate. We'll see you next week, and hopefully that whirlwind won't see you this weekend.